The bartender jerked his thumb at the screens inset into the bar. Menus. Scarlet frowned. Never mind, I'll order something back at the room. The bartender showed no sign of having heard her. It was nice to meet you, Ran. He propped an elbow on the counter, twisting his stool toward her. Perhaps our paths will cross again. In Paris. Hair prickled on her neck as he settled his chin onto his palm. She noticed with a jolt of disgust that each of his fingernails had been filed into a sharp, perfect point. Perhaps, she said, her tone suffused with politeness. The instinctual alarm hung with her for two whole cars as she made her way back through the train, a warning buzzing in the air. She tried to shake it off. This was her own nerves playing tricks on her, paranoia finally catching up to her after what had happened to her grandmother and her father. It was amazing she could carry on a conversation at all with all the panic that was residing just beneath the surface of her skin. He'd been polite. He'd been a gentleman. Maybe talon-like nails were a growing trend in the city. Just as she'd determined that nothing about Ran had been deserving of the sudden, ardent distrust, she remembered. She had seen him on the platform in Toulouse, stepping off the escalator in his ratty jeans and no luggage, when Wolf had become so on edge. When it seemed like Wolf had heard something, or recognized someone. A coincidence? The speaker overhead crackled. Scarlet barely heard it over the noise of the corridor, until the repeated words gradually silenced the chatter around her. Experiencing a temporary delay, all passengers are to return to their private quarters immediately and stay clear of the corridors until further notice is given. This is not a test. We are experiencing a temporary delay. Chapter 18. Scarlet shut the door behind her, relieved that Wolf was still there, pacing. He swiveled toward her.
I just heard the announcement, she said. Do you know what's going on?
No, I was wondering if you might. She wrapped her fingers around the port screen in her pocket.
Some sort of delay. It seems odd to clear the corridors, though.
He didn't respond. His scowl became fierce, almost angry.
You smell.
When he didn't continue, an offended laugh erupted out of her.
I smell?
Wolf roughly shook his head, hair whipping across his creased brow.
Not like that. Who did you talk to out there?
Frowning, she fell back against the door. If Ran had been wearing cologne, it had been too faint for her to pick up.
Why?
She snapped, annoyed as much with his accusation as with the unexpected sting of guilt it caused.
Is it any of your business?
His jaw tensed.
No, that's not what I...
He paused, eyes flickering past her. A knock startled Scarlet away from the wall. She turned and yanked open the door. An android rolled into the room, scanner at the end of its wiry arm.
We are performing an identity check for the safety of all passengers. Please show your ID for scanning.
Scarlet raised her hand on instinct. She didn't think to question the order until a red light passed over her skin, beeped, and the android turned to Wolf.
What's going on? She said. We scanned our tickets when we boarded.
Another beep. You are not to leave this room until further instructions are given.
That wasn't an answer, said Scarlet.
A panel opened in the android's torso, and a third limb reached out to greet them. This one fitted with a slender syringe.
I must now conduct a mandatory blood check. Please extend your right arm.
Scarlet gawked down at the gleaming needle.
You're running blood tests? That's ridiculous. We're just going to Paris.
Please extend your right arm, the android repeated, or I will be forced to report you for failure to comply with maglev rail safety regulations. Your tickets will be considered invalid and you will be escorted off the train at the next station.
Scarlet bristled and glanced at Wolf, but he had eyes only for the syringe.
For a moment, Scarlet thought he was going to smash in the robot's sensor, before he reluctantly stretched out his arm. Wolf's expression became distant while the needle punctured his skin. The moment the android had withdrawn a blood sample and retracted the skeletal limb, Wolf backed away and folded his arm against his chest. A fear of needles? Scarlet squinted at him, holding out her own elbow as the android produced another syringe. She couldn't imagine it hurt any more than that tattoo had. Scowling, she watched as the syringe filled with her own blood.
"What exactly are you looking for?"
she said as the android finished and both syringes disappeared into its body.
"Initiating blood scan," said the android, followed by a clatter of humming and beeps.
Wolf had just tucked his arm against his side when the android pronounced,
"Scan complete. Please shut the door and remain in this room until further instructions are given."
"You already said that,"
Scarlet said to the android's back as it retreated into the hall. Pressing a thumb against the small puncture wound, Scarlet slammed the door shut with her foot.
"What was that all about? I have half a mind to calm the maglev customer service and issue a complaint."
Turning, she found Wolf already at the window. His steps had been soundless.
"We're slowing down."
It was a silent, agonizing moment before Scarlet felt it too. Through the window, she could see a thick canopy of forest choking off the midday sun. There were no roads, no buildings. They weren't stopping at a station. She opened her mouth, but Wolf's expression stopped her question before it could form.
"Do you hear that?"
Scarlet tugged the zipper of her hoodie down to let air on her neck and listened. The hum of magnets. The whistle of air passing through an open window in the next cabin. The rattle of luggage.
Wailing. So distant, it sounded like a fading nightmare.
Cold goosebumps grazed her arms.
"What's going on out there?"
The wall speaker clattered.
"Passengers, this is your conductor speaking. There has been a medical emergency aboard the train. We will be experiencing a delay while we wait for medical authorities. We ask that all passengers remain in their private quarters and comply with any requests from the staff androids. Thank you for your patience."
The speaker fell silent, leaving Scarlet and Wolf staring at each other. Scarlet's throat constricted. A blood test? Crying. A delay.
"The plague,"
Wolf said nothing.
"They'll put the whole train on lockdown," she said. "We'll all be quarantined."
Out in the hall, doors were slamming, neighbors yelling questions and speculations at each other, ignoring the conductor's request to stay in their own rooms. The android must have moved on to the next car. Scarlet heard the rushed words, "Letemosis outbreak," posed as a question. A fear.
"No,"
she spat the word like a bullet.
"They can't keep us here. My grandma."
Her voice hitched, a tide of panic overwhelming her. Someone down the hall pounded erratically on a door. The distant wailing grew louder.
"Get your things," said Wolf.
She and Wolf moved at the same time. She threw her port screen into her pack while Wolf crossed the window and flung it open. The ground raced beneath them. Beyond the tracks, a dense forest stretched out, dissolving into shadows. Scarlet checked the pistol in her waistband.
"Are we jumping?"
"Yes, but they might be expecting it, so we have to do it before the train slows too much. They're probably prepping enforcement androids right now to round up runaways."
Scarlet nodded.
"If it is letemosis, we've probably already become a quarantine."
Wolf thrust his head out the window, looking both ways down the length of the train.
"Now's our best chance."
Pulling inside, he heaved the bag onto one shoulder. Scarlet peered down at the ground, fleeing beneath them, dizzied by a moment of vertigo. It was impossible to focus on any one spot as the speckled sun flashed against the trees.
"Well, this seems dangerous.
We'll be fine."
She peered up at him, for a moment expecting to meet that crazed madman again. But his expression was stone cold and clinical. He was focused hard on the landscape that whizzed by them.
"They're breaking," he said. We'll start slowing down faster now.
Again, it was a few seconds before Scarlet sensed it too, the subtle shift in speed, the way they were decelerating fast, no longer just coasting to a steady stop.
Wolf inclined his head. Climb onto my back.
I can jump myself.
Scarlet!
She met his eyes. His youthful curiosity from before was gone, replaced with a sternness she hadn't expected.
What? It'll be just like jumping off the barn into a haystack. I've done that 100 times.
A haystack? Honestly, Scarlet, it'll be nothing like that.
Before she could argue, before she could cement her defiance, he bent over her and scooped her into both arms. She gasped and had just enough time to open her mouth, ready to demand he put her down, before Wolf was on the windowsill, the wind whipping Scarlet's curls against her neck. He jumped. Scarlet yelped and grabbed onto him, her stomach somersaulting, and then the shock of landing jogged up her spine. She dug her fingers into his shoulders. Every limb trembled. Wolf had landed in a clearing 8 steps beyond the tracks. He staggered into the tree line and hunkered into the shadows.
All right? He asked.
Just like, she caught her breath, a haystack.
A laugh reverberated through his chest into her, and before she was ready, Wolf settled her feet onto a patch of squishy moss. She scrambled out of his hold, caught her balance, then punched him squarely in the arm.
Never do that again!
He looked almost pleased with himself before he tilted his head toward the forest.
We should move farther in case someone saw us.
She listened to the train zipping by, her pulse heavy and erratic, and followed Wolf into the trees. They hadn't gone 12 steps when the thrumming of the train disappeared, fading away down the tracks. Scarlet dug her port out of the bag on Wolf's shoulder and checked their location.
Great. The nearest town is 20 miles east of here. It's out of our way, but maybe someone can give us a ride to the next maglev station.
Because we seem so trustworthy?
Scarlet peered up at him, noting the pale, scattered scars and the faded black eye.
What's your idea?
We should stay on the tracks. Another train will be by eventually.
And they'll give us a lift?
Sure.
This time? She was sure she caught mischief in his eye as he started back down the rails, but they hadn't gone 12 steps when he halted mid-step.
What?
Wolf spun on her, clamping one hand behind her head, the other firmly over her mouth. Tensing, Scarlet moved to shove him away, but something gave her pause. He was staring off into the forest, brow furrowed. Tilting his nose up, he sniffed the air. When he was sure she wouldn't make a sound, he snatched his hands away as if something had stung him. Scarlet stumbled back, surprised by the sudden release. They lingered, still and silent, Scarlet straining to listen for what had Wolf on edge. Slowly reaching behind her, she pulled the gun from her waistband. The click as she released the safety echoed off the trees. Off in the woods, a wolf howled. The lonely cry sent a shiver down Scarlet's spine. Wolf didn't seem surprised. Then, behind them, another howl. This one farther away. Then, another to the north. Silence crept around them as the howls faded longingly into the air.
Friends of yours? Scarlet asked.
Clarity returned to Wolf's expression, and he glanced at her, then down at the gun. It struck her as odd that he could be startled by it, when the howls had garnered no reaction at all.
They won't bother us, he said finally, turning and heading down the tracks.
With a snort, Scarlet trotted after him.
Well, isn't that a relief? We're stranded in wild wolf territory, but as long as you say they're not going to bother us...
She clicked the gun's safety back on, and was tucking it back in her waistband when Wolf's gesture gave her pause.
They won't bother us, he said, almost smiling. But you might want to keep that out anyway, just in case.
Chapter 19.
What is all this junk?
Cinder locked her jaw,
straining to push a plastic crate that was almost as tall as she was. Thorn grunted beside her.
It's not junk.
The tendons in his neck bulged as the crate collided with the cargo bay wall. Thorn tossed his arms over the top with a groan, and Cinder collapsed against it. Her shoulders ached, as tense as the metal that made up her left leg, but her arms felt like they were about to fall off. But when she allowed herself to look around the cargo bay, a sense of accomplishment settled around her. All the crates had been slid to the walls, clearing an actual path from the cockpit to the living quarters. The smaller, lighter ones had been stacked on top of one another, and some were left out as makeshift furniture in front of the main net screen. It bordered on cozy. The next job would be to actually unpack the crates, the ones that were worth unpacking. But that would be a job for another day.
No, really, she said when she'd found her breath. What is all this?
Thorn slid down beside her and wiped his brow with his sleeve.
I don't know, he said, eyeing the stamped labels on the side of the nearest crate, an unhelpful code. Supplies, food. I think there are some guns in one of them. And I know I had a few sculptures from this really collectible second-era artist. I was going to make a fortune off of them. But I got arrested before I had a chance, he sighed.
Cinder squinted at him. Sure that the sculptures were stolen, she found it difficult to muster any sympathy.
Shame, she muttered, thumping her head back against the crate.
Thorn pointed at something on the far wall, his forearm jetting beneath Cinder's nose.
What's that?
She followed his gesture, frowned, and with a cranky moan, pushed herself back to her feet. The corner of a metal frame could be seen behind a tall stack of crates they'd left against the wall.
A door?
She drew up the ship's blueprint on her retina display.
The med bay?
Realization brightened Thorn's face.
Oh, right! This ship does have one of those!
Cinder settled her fists on her hips.
You covered up the med bay?
Thorn pulled himself up.
Never needed it.
Don't you think it might be good to have access to, just in case?
Thorn shrugged.
We'll see.
Rolling her eyes, Cinder reached for the uppermost crate and hauled it down onto the floor, already disrupting their hard-won pathway.
How can we be sure there's nothing in these boxes that can be tracked?
What do you think, I'm an amateur?
Nothing entered this ship without being thoroughly inspected. Otherwise, the Republic would have reclaimed it all a long time ago rather than let it idle in that warehouse.
There may not be any trackers, said Iko, making Cinder and Thorn both jump.
They still weren't used to their invisible, omnipresent companion.
But we can still be detected on radar. I'm doing my best to keep us out of the path of any satellites or ships, but it's surprisingly crowded up here.
Thorn unrolled his sleeves. And it's next to impossible to re-enter Earth's atmosphere without detection. That's how they nabbed me last time.
I thought there was a trick to it, said Cinder. I'm sure I heard once about a way people could sneak into Earth's atmosphere without notice. Where did I hear that?
News to me. I got pretty good at sweet-talking my way into public hangars, but I don't think that's going to work with such a high-profile convict on the loose.
Having found an old rubber band in the galley, Cinder fished it from her pocket and tossed her hair up in a ponytail. Her brain ticked through her memories unit, until, with a snap, it came to her. Dr. Erland had told her that there were more Lunars on Earth than people suspected, and that they had a way of getting to Earth without the government taking notice.
Lunars know how to cloak their spacecrafts.
Huh?
She pulled herself from the daze, blinking at Thorn.
Lunars can cloak their spacecrafts, keep Earth and radars from picking up on them. That's how so many are able to make it to Earth, if they manage to get away from Luna in the first place.
That's terrifying, said Iko, who had acknowledged the truth of Cinder's race, much as she'd acknowledged Thorn's convict status,
with loyalty and acceptance, but without changing her opinion that Lunars and convicts remained untrustworthy and unredeemable as a general rule.
Cinder had not yet figured out how to tell her that she also happened to be the missing Princess Celine.
I know it is, said Cinder, but it would be awfully convenient if I knew how they did it.
Do you think it's with their, Thorn rolled his wrist toward her, crazy lunar magic stuff?
Bioelectricity, she said, quoting Dr. Erland. Calling it magic only empowers them.
Whatever.
I don't know. It could be some special technology they install on their ships.
Optimistically hoping it's magic, maybe you should start practicing?
Cinder bit the inside of her cheek. Start practicing what?
I guess I can try.
Turning her attention back to the crate, she pulled up the lid and was met with the box of packing chips. She stuffed her metal hand into it and emerged with a skinny wooden doll bedecked in feathers and painted with six eyes.
What is this?
Venezuelan dream doll?
It's hideous.
It's worth about 10,000 univs.
Heart skipping, Cinder lowered the doll back into the protective packaging.
You don't think you might have something useful in all of these, like, I don't know, a fully charged power cell?
Doubtful, said Thorn. How much longer will ours hold out?
Aiko chimed.
Approximately 37 hours.
Thorn gave Cinder a thumbs up.
Plenty of time to learn a new lunar trick, right?
Cinder shut the crate's lid and slid it back against the others, trying not to show panic at having to use her new gift for anything, much less something as huge as disguising a cargo ship.
In the meantime, I'll do a little research, try to determine the best place for us to land. Not the Commonwealth, obviously. I hear Fiji's nice this time of year.
Or Los Angeles, Aiko practically sang. They have a huge escort droid outlet store there. I wouldn't mind having an escort droid body. Some of the newer models come with color-changing fiber-optic hair.
Cinder slumped onto the floor again and scratched at her wrist, a tic that was becoming awkward now that she had no gloves to fiddle with.
We're not landing a stolen American ship in the American Republic, she said, fixing her attention on the net screen, where her own prison picture hovered in the corner. She was so sick of that picture.
Do you have any suggestions? Said Thorn.
Africa.
She heard herself saying it, but nothing came out. That's where she was supposed to go, to meet Dr. Erland, so that he could tell her what to do next. He had plans for her. Plans to make her a hero, a savior, a princess. Plans to overthrow Levana and instate Cinder as the true queen. Her right hand started to shake. Dr. Erland had set up the cyborg draft and treated dozens, perhaps hundreds of cyborgs like throwaways, all for the sake of finding her. And then, when he found her, he kept the secret of her identity until he had no other choice but to tell her, all the while planning out the rest of her life. He had made his need for revenge the highest priority. But what the doctor hadn't considered was that Cinder had no desire to be queen. She didn't want to be a princess or an heir to anything. All her life, at least all the life she could remember, all she'd ever wanted was freedom. And now, for the first time, she had it, however tenuous it was. There was no one telling her what to do, no one to judge or criticize. But if she went to Dr. Erland, she would lose all that. He would expect her to reclaim her rightful place as the Queen of Luna. And that struck her as the most binding shackles of all. Cinder gripped her shaking hand with the steady cyborg one. She was tired of everyone deciding her life for her. She was ready to figure out who she really was, not what anyone else told her to be.
Cinder?
Europe. She pressed her back into the crate, forcing herself to sit straight, to feign certainty. We're going to Europe. A brief silence.
Any reason in particular?
She met his gaze and pondered a long moment before choosing her words. Do you believe in the lunar air? Thorn propped his chin on both palms.
Of course.
No, I mean, do you believe she's still alive? He peered at her as if she were being cute,
Because it was so vague the first time? Yes, of course. I think she's alive.
Cinder drew back. You do?
Sure. I know some people think it's all conspiracy theories, but I've heard that Queen Lavanna was really paranoid for months after that fire, when she should have been ecstatic because she was finally queen, right? It's like she knew the princess had gotten away.
Yeah, but those could only be stories, Cinder said, not knowing why she was trying to dissuade him.
Perhaps because she'd never believed any of it until she'd known the truth. He shrugged. What does this have to do with Europe?
Cinder shifted to face him more fully, crisscrossing her legs. There's a woman who lives there, or at least she used to live there. She used to be in their military. Her name is Michelle Benoit, and I think she might be connected to the missing princess. She took in a slow breath, hoping she hadn't said anything that could give her secret away.
Where did you hear this?
An android told me, a royal android.
Oh, Kai's android?
Aiko said, excitedly changing the screen to one of Kai's fan pages. Cinder sighed. Yes, His Majesty's android. Unbeknownst to her at the time, her cyborg brain had recorded every word that the android, Nancy, had spoken, as if it had known that Cinder would someday need to draw on this information again. According to Nancy's research, a lunar doctor named Logan Tanner had brought Cinder to Earth when she was still a child, after Lavanna's murder attempt had failed. He'd eventually been incarcerated in a psychiatric hospital and committed suicide, but not before passing her off to someone else. Nancy had thought that someone else was an ex-military pilot from the European Federation. Wing Commander Michelle Benoit.
A royal android, Thorne said, showing the first sign of speculation. And how did it get this information?
That I have no idea. But I want to find this Michelle Benoit and see if it was right. And hope that Michelle Benoit had some answers that Dr. Erlon didn't. Perhaps she could tell Cinder about her history, about those 11 long years lost to her memory, about her surgery and the surgeons and Lynn Garen's invention that had kept Cinder from using her lunar gift until Dr. Erlon had disabled it. Perhaps she had her own ideas about what Cinder should do next. Ideas that left her some choices for the rest of her life.
I'm in. She started.
You are?
Sure, this is the biggest unsolved mystery of the Third Era. There's got to be someone out there offering a reward for finding this princess, right?
Yeah, Queen Lavanna. Thorne tilted toward her, nudging her with his elbow.
In that case, we already have something in common with the princess, don't we?
He winked, setting Cinder's nerve on edge.
I just hope she's cute.
Could you at least try to focus on the important things?
That would be important.
Thorne pulled himself up with a groan, still sore from all the rearranging.
Hungry? I think there's a can of beans in there calling my name.
No, I'm fine, thank you. When he had gone, Cinder hefted herself up onto the nearest crate and rolled out her shoulders. The news was still broadcasting on the screen, muted. A ticker read, Hunt continues for lunar fugitive Lynn Cinder and crown traitor Dimitri Erlond. Her throat constricted.
Crown traitor?
She shouldn't have been surprised. How long had she expected it to take them to figure out who had helped her escape? Cinder sank onto her back, feet dangling off the crate, and stared at the maze of pipes and bundled wires that cluttered the ship's rafters. Was she making a mistake by going to Europe? It was a draw she didn't think she could resist, not only because of what Nancy had said, but because of Cinder's own jumbled memories, too. She'd always known that she'd been adopted in Europe, and she had the faintest recollection of it, only drug-muddled memories that she'd always thought might be part dream. A barn, a snow-covered field, a gray sky that never ended, and then a long, long train ride bringing her to New Beijing and her new family. She felt compelled to go there now, to figure out where she had been during all those lost years and who had taken care of her, who else knew her biggest secret.
But what if she was only avoiding the inevitable? What if this was just a distraction to keep her from going to Dr. Erland and accepting her fate? At least the doctor could teach her how to be a Lunar, how to protect herself from Queen Levana. She didn't even know how to use her glamour. Not properly, anyway. Pursing her lip, she held her cyborg hand up over her face. Its metal plating shone almost mirror-like beneath the ship's dim lights. It was so pristine, so well-crafted. It did not seem like her hand. Not yet. Tilting her head, Cinder held up her other human hand beside it and tried to imagine what it would be like to be fully human. Two limbs made of skin and tissue and bones. Blood pumping in faintly blue veins beneath the surface. All 10 fingernails. An electric current traipsed down her nerves, and her cyborg hand began to morph in her vision. Little wrinkles appeared in her knuckles. Tendons stretched beneath her skin. The edges softened, warmed, turned to flesh. She was looking at two hands, two human hands, small and dainty with perfectly sculpted fingers and delicate rounded nails. She flexed the fingers of her left hand, forming a fist, then stretched them out again. An almost giddy laugh fell out of her. She was doing it. She was using her glamour. She did not need gloves anymore. She could convince everyone that this was real. No one would ever know she was cyborg again. The realization was stark and sudden and overwhelming. And then, too soon, an orange light flickered in the corner of her vision, her brain warning her that what she was seeing was a lie, that this was not real, would never be real. She sat up with a gasp and squeezed her eyes shut before her retina scanner could start to pick up on all the little inaccuracies and falsehoods like it had done with Levana's glamour when Cinder had begun to see through it. She was annoyed with herself, disgusted at how easily the desire had come to her. This was how Levana did it. She kept a hold on her people by tricking both their eyes and their hearts. She ruled with fear, yes, but also with adoration. It would be easy to abuse a person when they never recognized it as abuse. It was not so different from when she glamoured Thorn. She'd owned his mind without even trying to, and he'd jumped at the chance to do her bidding. She sat shivering for a while, listening to Thorn banging around in the galley and humming to himself. If this was her chance to decide who she was, who she wanted to be, then the first decision was an easy one. She would never be like Queen Levana. Chapter 20. The tracks magnets had gone silent, replaced with the sounds of their own footsteps in the brush and the caws of migrating birds. Only a suggestion of sun filtered down through the thick tree cover, and the forest smelled of tree sap and the coming of autumn. Time seemed to stretch on for eons, although Scarlet's port screen indicated that not even an hour had passed when they came across the stopped train. Scarlet first noticed sounds that didn't belong to the forest, the crunching of treads on dirt and gravel as dozens of androids circled the perimeter. Wolf abandoned the tracks, pushing through the brush and leading them into the security of the woods. Scarlet tucked away the port so she could use both hands to climb fallen logs and keep twigs and spider webs out of her hair. After a while, she tugged her hood over her head, lessening her vision but feeling better protected from the things that reached and jabbed at her. They climbed up an embankment, using the roots of a pine tree that looked about to topple over onto the tracks. On higher ground, Scarlet could see the dappled glint of sunlight off the train's metal roof. The occasional passenger cast a shadow against the windows. Scarlet could not imagine being among them. Surely everybody knew what the medical emergency was by now. How long would it take to test every passenger for the plague and determine who could be let go? How long could they keep healthy people quarantined? Or would they let them go at all? To prevent escapees, a small army of androids patrolled around the train,
their yellow sensors shuffling over the windows and doors, occasionally darting toward the forest. Though Scarlet didn't think they could see her so high above the tracks, she nevertheless crept back from the embankment and slowly, slowly unzipped her hoodie. Wolf glanced back just as she was pulling her arms from the sleeves, glad she was wearing a much more camouflage-worthy black tank top underneath. She cinched the hoodie tight around her waist. "Better?" she mouthed, but Wolf only glanced away.
"They'll have noticed we're missing," he whispered.
The nearest android spun toward them, and Scarlet ducked, worried that even her hair could draw attention. When the android rolled away again, Wolf slinked forward, holding back a tree branch for Scarlet to pass beneath. They moved at a tractor's pace, crouched low to keep out of sight. It seemed every step Scarlet took sent another creature scurrying away for cover. A squirrel, a tiny swallow, and she feared that the androids would be able to track them by the disturbed wildlife alone. But no warning alarm came from the tracks. They stopped only once, when a streak of blue light danced on the trunks over their heads. Scarlet followed Wolf's lead and pressed herself nearly to the ground, listening to the pounding of her heart, the rush of adrenaline in her ears. With a start, she felt Wolf's warm fingers pressing into her back. They were steady against her, calming, as she watched the android's light scan back and forth, darting into the forest canopy. She risked the slightest tilt of her head until she could see Wolf beside her, immobile, every muscle taut, except the fingers of his other hand, which were tapping, tapping, tapping against a large rock, expelling the nervous energy that had nowhere else to go. She watched the fingers, half mesmerized, and didn't realize that the light had flickered away until the pressure of Wolf's touch lifted from her back. They prowled on. Soon the train was behind them, the noise of lost civilization fading in the chatter of crickets and toads. When Wolf seemed satisfied they weren't being followed, he led them out of the forest and back down to the tracks. Despite the growing distance between them and the train, neither spoke. Just as the sun was kissing the horizon, almost blindingly bright in those rare moments when it could be glimpsed through the trees, Wolf stopped and turned back. Scarlet halted a few steps ahead of him and followed his gaze, but she saw nothing but overgrown sticker bushes and long shadows that had no end. Her ears were perked, listening for another howl, but she couldn't pick up anything but bird chatter and, overhead, the squeaks of a colony of bats. "More wolves?" she finally asked. A long silence, followed by a terse nod. "More wolves." It wasn't until he started walking again that Scarlet released a captured breath. They'd been walking for hours without sign of another train, a cross-section of tracks, or civilization. On one hand, it was beautiful here. The fresh air, the wildflowers, the critters that came to the edge of the brush to watch Scarlet and Wolf before scurrying back into the ferns. But on the other hand, her feet and back were sore. Her stomach was growling, and now Wolf was telling her that the less lovable creatures of the forest were prowling nearby. A chill rushed up her arms. Untying her hoodie from her waist, she tugged it on and yanked the zipper up to her neck. Pulling out her port screen, she deflated to see that they'd gone a mere 18 miles, that they had another 30 to go before they reached the nearest station. "There's a junction coming up in about a half mile."
"Good," said Wolf. "Whatever trains were scheduled to come through on these tracks won't be making it through any time soon. We should start seeing some trains after the junction."
"And when this train comes," she said, "how do you plan on getting us onto it?"
"Same way we got off the last one." He sent a sly grin toward her. "Like jumping off a barn, was it?"
She glared.
"The comparison doesn't work as well for jumping back onto a train."
His response was that same teasing smile, and Scarlet turned away, thinking that maybe she didn't want to know what his plan was, so long as he had one. A late flowering shrub trembled just off the path, and Scarlet's heart thumped, until a harmless pine marten crawled out and disappeared into the trees. She sighed, annoyed at her restlessness.
So, she said, disrupting Wolf in another backward glance, who would win in a fight, you or a pack of wolves?
He frowned at her, all seriousness. Depends, he said, slowly, like he was trying to figure out her motive for asking. How big is the pack?
I don't know, what's normal, 6?
I could win against 6, he said. Any more than that, and it could be a close call.
Scarlet smirked. You're not in danger of low self-esteem, at least.
What do you mean?
Nothing at all. She kicked a stone from their path. How about you and a lion?
A cat? Don't insult me.
She laughed, the sound sharp and surprising. How about a bear?
Why, do you see one out there?
Not yet, but I want to be prepared in case I have to rescue you.
The smile she'd been waiting for warmed his face, a glint of white teeth flashing. I'm not sure. I've never had to fight a bear before.
He cocked his head toward the east.
There's a lake that way, maybe 100 yards. We should refill the water.
Wait. Wolf paused, glanced at her.
Scarlet's brow was creased as she inched toward him.
Do that again.
He took half a step back, eyes glinting with sudden nerves.
Do what?
Smile.
The order was met with the opposite response. Wolf shrank back, his jaw tense, as if to be sure his lips stayed locked together.
Scarlet hesitated only a moment before reaching for him. He winced, but didn't move as she cupped his chin and gently pulled open his lips with her thumb. He took in a hissing breath before touching his tongue to the point of his right tooth. But they were not normal. They were almost fang-like, with sharp, elongated canines. She realized, too slowly, they were like wolf teeth. Wolf turned his face away, locking his jaw again. His whole body stayed tense, uncomfortable. She saw him gulp.
Implants?
He scratched the back of his neck, unable to look at her.
That order of the pack sure takes this wolf thing seriously, don't they?
Finding her hand still hovering in midair, her fingers dangerously close to tilting Wolf's face back toward her, she let it fall and tucked it into her front pocket. Her heart was suddenly racing.
So are there any other oddities I should know about? A tail, perhaps?
Finally, he met her gaze, flushed with insult, until he found her smiling up at him.
I'm joking, she said, offering an apologetic grin. They're only teeth. At least they're not implanted on your scalp like that guy at the fights had.
It took a moment, but soon his embarrassment started to melt, his scowl softening around the edges, his lips turned up again. But it was not another true smile. She nudged his foot with her toes.
All right, I'll accept that smile for now.
You said you had a river nearby?
Seemingly grateful to be released from the conversation, Wolf ducked back from her.
A lake, he said. I can smell it.
Scarlet squinted in the direction he'd gestured, seeing nothing but more trees, the same old trees.
Of course you can,
she said, following as he pushed into the undergrowth.
And he was right, though it was more a pond than a lake, kept fresh by a creek that flowed in and out on the far side.
The shore changed from grass to rocks before disappearing beneath the surface, and a cluster of beech trees hung their branches toward the water. Rolling up her sleeves, Scarlet splashed some water on her face and slurped up big handfuls. She hadn't realized how thirsty she was until she'd found that she couldn't stop drinking it. Wolf busied himself dunking his hands and wetting his wet fingers through his hair, making it stand in each direction as if it had gotten too tame during their trek. Refreshed, Scarlet sat back on her heels and glanced across at Wolf.
I don't believe it.
He met her gaze.
Your hands aren't twitching, she said,
gesturing at the palm set loosely on his knee. It instantly flexed into a fist, his fingers uncomfortable beneath her scrutiny.
Maybe the forest is having a good effect on you.
Wolf seemed to consider this, his brow drawn as he topped off the water bottle and nestled it into the bag.
Maybe so, he said.
Then,
is there any more food?
No, I didn't realize we'd be living off our own reserves.
Scarlet laughed.
Now that you mention it, here I am thinking the fresh air must be working a miracle when you're probably just suffering from low blood sugar.
Come on, maybe we'll come across some wild berries or something.
She moved to stand when she heard quacking on the other side of the lake. Half a dozen ducks were making their way into the water, paddling out and dipping their heads beneath the surface. Scarlet bit her lip.
Or do you think you could catch one of those?
As he shifted his attention to the ducks, a daring grin spread over his face. He made it look easy, prowling up to the unsuspecting birds like a born predator. But if Scarlet was impressed, and perhaps she was, it was nothing compared to his awe as he watched her defeather the dead fowl like a trained expert, pricking holes in its skin to allow for the outer layer of fat to drain out while it cooked. The trickiest part was lighting a fire, but with a quick search on her port screen and a clever use of the gunpowder in one of her gun's cartridges, Scarlet was soon mesmerized by the gray plumes of a small fire winding their way toward the forest canopy. Wolf's attention was off in the woods as he stretched his long legs in front of him.
How long have you lived on the farm?
He asked, digging his heel into the dirt. Scarlet settled her elbows over her knees and stared impatiently at the duck.
Since I was 7.
Why did you leave Paris? She peered up at him, but his attention was caught on the tranquil water.
I was miserable there. After my mom left, my dad preferred to spend his time at the bar instead of with me. So I came to live with grand-mère.
And were you happier there?
She shrugged.
It took some getting used to. I went from being a pretty spoiled city kid to getting up at dawn and being expected to finish my chores. I had my share of rebellions, but it wasn't the same. When I lived with my dad, I used to throw fits and tantrums, break things and make up stories and anything I could just to get his attention, to get him to care. But I never did any of that with grand-mère. We would sit in the garden on warm nights and just talk, and she would actually listen to what I said. She treated my opinions like they were valid, like I had something worthwhile to say.
Her eyes fogged as she stared into the ashes beneath the flames.
Half the time, we'd end up fighting with each other, because we both have such big opinions and are too stubborn to ever admit we're wrong about something. But there would always reach this point, every single time, when one of us would be yelling or just about ready to stomp away and slam the door, and then my grandma would just start laughing. And then, of course, I would start laughing, and she'd say that I was just like her.
She gulped, tightening her arms around her knees.
She'd say that I was bound to have a tough life because I was just like her.
Scarlet rubbed her palms against her lashes, smearing away the tears before they could fall. Wolf waited for her breaths to steady before asking,
"Was it always just the two of you?"
She nodded, and when she was sure she'd stifled the tears, peeled her hands away. She sniffed and reached forward to flip the wings, their skin already blackened.
"Yep, just the two of us. Grand-mère never married. Whoever my grandpa was, he's been out of the picture for a long time. She never really talked about it."
"And you didn't have any siblings, or adopted siblings? Wards?"
"Wards?"
Scarlet swiped her sleeve across her nose and squinted at him.
"No, it was just me."
She added a branch to the fire.
"How about you? Any siblings?"
Wolf curled his fingers into the rocks.
"One, a younger brother.
Scarlet barely heard him over the crackle of the flames. She felt the weight of those three words, a younger brother. Wolf's expression showed neither affection nor coldness. He struck her as someone who would be protective of a younger sibling, but his face seemed hardened against that instinct.
"Where is he now?" she asked. "Does he still live with your parents?"
Leaning forward, Wolf adjusted the nearest duck leg.
"No, neither of us have spoken to our parents in a very long time."
Scarlet refocused on the cooking bird.
"Not getting along with your parents. I guess that's something we have in common, then."
Wolf's grip locked around the drumstick, and only when a spark lanced out at him from the fire did he retract his arm.
"I loved my parents,"
he said with the tenderness that had been missing when he mentioned his brother.
"Oh," she said dumbly, "are they dead?"
She flinched at her crudeness, wishing just once she knew when to hold her tongue. But Wolf seemed more resigned than hurt as he picked through the rocks beside him.
"I don't know. There are rules that come with being a member of the pack. One is that you cut all ties with people from your past, including your family. Especially your family."
She shook her head, baffled.
"But if you had a good home life, why did you even join them in the first place?"
"I wasn't given a choice," he scratched behind his ear. "My brother wasn't given one either when they came for him, a few years after they took me. But that never seemed to bother him like it bothered me."
He trailed off, tossing a stone into the water.
"It's complicated, and it doesn't matter anymore."
She frowned. It was unfathomable to her that you wouldn't have a choice to live that lifestyle. To leave your home and family. To join a violent gang. But before she could press him further, Wolf's attention swiveled back toward the train tracks, and he leapt to his feet. Scarlet turned, her heart landing in her throat. The man from the dining car crept out of the shadows, quiet as a cat. He was still smiling, but it was nothing like that teasing, flirtatious grin she'd seen on him before. It took her a slow, blank moment to recall his name. Ran. Tipping his head back, Ran sniffed longingly at the air.